Chapter 3. To be Forgotten. They took away our hair. "My children," Mr. John Benali said, after teaching us how to say hello in English, "I am sorry, but you must go now into this room." We did as he asked. One by one, we were herded into a little shed where three tall, uniformed Navajo boys, whose hair was as short as Mr. John Benali's, were waiting. I should explain, grandchildren, that in those days, among our people, both men and women always kept their hair long. It was a sacred thing. Cutting your hair was believed to bring misfortune to you. But at mission school, they had other beliefs. I was the first one in line. Two of the uniformed boys took me by my arms, one on each side, and pulled me over to a chair. "What are you doing?" I asked in Navajo, just loud enough so that they could hear. But they didn't answer me. Instead, they pushed me down onto that hard wooden chair and held me firmly, as if I were a sheep about to be sheared. Then another boy with a big pair of scissors chopped off my hair. He did it so quickly that it was over almost before I knew it. Another stunned child was being led in and shoved into that chair even before I was out the door. Both boys and girls had their hair cut. The only difference was that the hair of the girls was left a little longer than the boys. But I could see from the looks on their faces that losing most of their beautiful hair made those girls feel the same way I felt, naked and ashamed. Not only was our hair stripped away, after being shorn, we were led into two separate buildings, one for the boys and another for the girls. Once we were inside, we were made to take off all our fine clothing and our jewelry. We never saw those clothes or jewels again. Years later, I learned that our squash blossom necklaces and turquoise bracelets, earrings and hair ornaments, and silver belts were sold to white men and women. In exchange for my clothing and jewelry, I was issued a military-style uniform made of cloth that was rough and itchy, and a stiff cap that was shoved down onto my head. The uniform and cap were too big for me, so big that my cap came down over my eyes. That made no difference to the older students who were handing out our new clothing. Once I was dressed, I was pushed out onto the schoolyard. There, we knew students were formed into a line and made to stand at attention, with the boys on one side of the yard, and the girls, who were now wearing long brown dresses, aprons, and head coverings, on the other. It was so strange, where only a few moments before there had been a colorful crowd of Navajo children, each one different from the other. Now we all looked just the same. In our drab uniforms, the only difference between us boys was our size. Of course, I was the smallest one. I remember thinking that they had removed from us everything that we owned, but I was wrong. There was still one more thing to be taken. We were led one by one to stand in front of a skinny white man with yellow hair who was sitting at a desk. A white board with curved black marks on it was propped up on that desk. None of us could read English, but I learned later that those curving marks that twisted like worms were the letters of the man's name, Mr. Reamer. I also learned later that he always did the job he was about to do with us new students because he had convinced himself that he understood our language. Mr. John Benali stood close to help with translating as Mr. Reamer asked each child the name of his or her father. That translation would help decide each student's new last name in English. For example, one of the boys in our group said he was the son of Bilin Dalbahe, one who has roan horses. He became John Roanhorse. Mr. Reamer seemed very fond of the name John and gave it to lots of boys. Also, if he didn't like the way someone's last name sounded in English when it was translated from Navajo, he would just choose another last name and give it to that boy or girl. We didn't know it at the time, but some of the last names we got were the names of famous dead white men: Washington, Lincoln, Jefferson, and so on. That was shocking to me when I discovered it later. Among our people, no one has ever deliberately given the name of someone who has died. When it came to me my turn, I stood at attention in front of the desk. The skinny yellow-haired white man said something to me. What he said sounded very strange. It didn't sound like any language I had ever heard before, not even the English that everyone around us was now speaking. Once again, the white man made those unpleasant noises. He sounded like someone trying to speak when his mouth is full of food. "He thinks he is talking Navajo," Mr. John Benali whispered into my ear. "He is trying to ask you the name of your father." "Dagalpahabiyet," I said. "I am the son of the one with a gray mustache." "Huh," said Mr. Reamer as he wrote something down on his paper. "Another begay. Because that white teacher couldn't really understand our language, he didn't realize that Biyet in Navajo just means son of. So he made Biyet my last name, although he wrote it as he heard it, Biyet. Lots of other white men at other schools did the same. That is why we now have so many Navajo families like our own with the last name of Biyet. But at least I was not named John. By the time the skinny white man got to me, he had already named more than 20 boys John, and he was tired of writing that name. So I was given the same first name as that teacher's dead uncle, Ned. Thus it was, grandchildren, that I began my day as Kiyeja and ended it as Ned Begay.